Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors. For each episode, we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at Hong Kong director Ricky Lau and his 1985 film, Mr. Vampire. Returning on the show today to talk about Mr. Vampire is Professor Merriduttler. Professor Dutter, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
So this was a really fun film. I'm always a big fan of like horror comedies because, you know, it plays all the horror tropes, you know, very, very lightheartedly. You don't take it too seriously. And it was a lot of fun, cool, like martial arts style action. Like we were talking earlier, it seems like a film that, you know, Jackie Chan would have done in the 80s at this time.
Yeah, one thing is that when you and I were talking before about, okay, so we're in October now, it's time to do things that are kind of scary, and we talked about this old dark house, and that was great, but you're like, so what other scary movies would you want to talk about? And I'm like, I am so bad at scary movies and rarely ever watch them that the closest thing I could come to a scary movie was Oof. Mr. Vampire. So like you talking about it being very much a horror comedy, mm-hmm. I guess in a similar vein to something like Shaun of the Dead, I guess. I've never seen Shaun of the Dead. But
oh,
I've,
my God.
Yeah, I know, but people have explained it to me, so it seems very much kind of like in that vein.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's the closest I can get to horror for you. But yeah, it is a very fun movie. Even though the costume design and the makeup on the vampires and the other kind of horror elements that are in it are enough for me to be scared enough.
You were scared a little bit by this movie?
I actually saw it at an anime convention, and I dreamed about hopping vampires after that. I just thought it was kind of interesting because, you know, it's that thing where, you know, you have something that's chasing you, even though it's not necessarily very fast. Like, I haven't mm-hmm. seen It Follows, but I know that the bad guy in It Follows is just walking towards people, and, you know, you can just pretty much get up and run away. But the fact that it's persistent, that it's totally always coming after you, and this idea of these hopping vampires, no, they're not incredibly fast, but they just, that image of them all hopping together was just, I don't know, it creeped me out.
Yeah, sure, you're talking about that. That is that, we think it's, you know, some a lot of people might think that was something silly created for the movie, but that is actually those are based on actual creatures in Chinese folklore. And I'm probably going to pronounce the name wrong, but I believe it's Jiangshi, that's what they call it?
Yeah, you got it. Jiangshi.
Oh, got it
yeah.
right. Yeah.
Hopping corpses. It's weird. What I really kind of like about this movie and what I also love about just watching foreign films in general is that you get all these different takes about what other cultures think of things that are so ingrained in ours. Because if you say the word vampire or you say the word zombie to an American audience, they're going to have some really kind of set ideas about what those mm-hmm. things are, how they function, what their attributes are, and then so when you say hopping vampires that look like desiccated corpses, you know, it's different. It's really interesting. I thought learning about their folklore and how they deal with elements of the undead was really cool.
It's really because I know, you know, the supernatural, you know, the elements of supernatural is a little bit of a touchy subject in China. Because,
oh, very much so, yeah.
Because I know... just talk about the recent news, 2016 in the summer, they banned Ghostbusters, the Ghostbusters remake, from playing in China. And because I think they figured the act, you know, considering the story of people hunting down spirits or something, they feel it was like insulting or in some way.
Yeah, I mean, there's been several instances of, because I can remember there was a Pirates of the Caribbean movie where they put Chow Yun-fat in it,
yep.
specifically so that they could get the movie into Asian markets, because Chow Yun-fat is a beloved Chinese actor.
Oh, yeah.
But there were elements of Pirates of the Caribbean that were supernatural and not in line with Chinese beliefs, and they banned the film. So, yeah, it's kind of almost weird when it comes to trying to get your movies into Chinese markets. You really do need to hire a consultant that's going to be able to give you an idea as to what they're going to let in and what they're not going to let in, because they are very, very particular about their folklore and to a point of being very exclusionary and touchy about it. So If you put something supernatural in your movie that's not going to fly there, it's simply not going to go there.
Now, is this, now are the, you know, is, you know, the calls for the banning, is it more implemented by their government or the people, or is it both?
It's the government.
Government, yeah, I figured.
because as you know, right now China is like the place that all Hollywood movies want to go to.
Yes.
Because they've got a lot of Chinese there that have a lot of money. So you've been seeing kind of this whole movie making by committee and what can sell internationally, especially in China. So if you are going to be making a movie, it's about, because the idea is that the government is there in order to be able to mediate between the people and the marketplace. So if you have a movie and the government doesn't think it's something the Chinese people will want to see because of things like supernatural elements that aren't aligned with what their beliefs are, then the government says no.
That's interesting. And since this film, I believe, is more of a Hong Kong studio than a mainland Chinese film. So
It is Hong Kong, and they actually shot a lot of the film in Taiwan too. So that also gives you a sense of this is not of the mainland. Because, anybody that doesn't know that China and Taiwan don't have the greatest relationship.
Not the best friends there.
not the best of friends. So, yeah, this is definitely, you know, mid-1980s, Hong Kong, some of the great Hong Kong movies that come out of the 1980s in Hong Kong. I mean, it's just, if you ever want to dive deep into a genre of film, 1980s Hong Kong films are a great place to dive into because there's so much imagination and energy there.
Yeah, and I think I want to tap on what you said is energy. And I think there's so much like energy in this film. It's like almost like everybody drank coffee when doing these films with the action and everything. And that's not an insult or any way. It's very fast. And I enjoyed it a lot. And you know, even when you watch something like Jackie Chan in Police Story, like he's just going, hopping and everything. And I think it's not an insult. I think it's just so much energy, especially in this time of period for the Hong Kong films, even in John Woo films.
You're right. There is a ton of energy in this film, but Ricky Lau made this like a Bataan Death March. I mean, people were working with very little sleep.
Oh wow.
Day after day after day. It was a really difficult shoot for the actors because they had different film crews, one working in the daytime, one working in the nighttime. Because when you watch the film, if you check this film out, because you really should because it's awesome, there's a lot of evening scenes, and there's also a good portion that are daytime scenes. And they didn't, like, break for that. They were just working around the clock. So some of these actors actually got sick towards the end of the shoot, because they were just constantly working all the time and getting very, very little sleep. So when you factor that into how much energy you're actually seeing on screen and some of these fight sequences, which are really, really, truly amazing, it's that just kind of gives you even more respect for the people that were working on this.
Yeah, and I can just imagine you're talking about the conditions, they were able to have that much energy, and especially in the action sequences, because the action sequences are pretty impressive. They're jumping, they're hopping, people are getting thrown into stuff and crashing through stuff. Imagine they took some blows, some kicks, and some punches to the face. I mean, it is pretty hard. And from what I've read, there wasn't a lot of stunt people on the movie. I'm pretty sure all these people were doing their own work.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's another thing, too, that's all great of 1980s Hong Kong films, is that these people were really kind of flying by the seat of their pants. They didn't go through the normal kind of Hollywood channels of insuring a film and insuring the people that were on a film, and they certainly didn't go through the same kind of safety precautions that we're used to seeing on Hollywood sets. So people like Jackie Chan are a great example of this, or Jet Li. Mm-hmm. Where when they're doing their stunts, and they're actually doing their own stunts, the capacity for them to get hurt and put down the production, if they were to get seriously hurt and not be able to work for a while, that could endanger the entire film.
Oh, yeah.
Because they only have so much of a budget, they only have so much of a shooting schedule, but they just went out and did it. And the people in this movie, too, I mean, the guy that plays Master Cao Lam, is an actor called Yang Ching-ying, and he was an assistant to Bruce Lee when he was really, really young.
Oh, wow.
Had trained in Peking opera some, but he was such a troublemaker, they kicked him out. So he was Bruce Lee's personal assistant, did a ton of action sequences and fight choreography in films all throughout the 1970s, and was in this film. So the amount of experience that you had working in these films, and again, energy level that you were talking about, but also this whole, you know, if something really goes wrong on this set, it could literally end, it could end the movie. So there's a sense of danger mm-hmm. when you're watching these 1980s Hong Kong films that is so fresh and different from anything coming out of Hollywood, which is why when you see people in Hollywood watching these films in the 1990s and really starting to get into them, then you start to see things like The Matrix and bringing people over like Yan Wuping, who had been exclusively working in Hong Kong up to that point, because they wanted that kind of fresh innovation in the fight sequences in American films.
Yeah, and even just talking about the amazing stunt sequences, one of the most amazing things in film and a stunt I've ever seen in a film is in Police Story. And it's at the end when he's Jackie Chan's chasing the bad guys in the mall, and he's sliding down that wall of light bulbs.
Light bulbs,
and
it's yeah.
And their light bulbs are popping and exploding behind him, and just
yeah,
like,
and he got third degree burns on his hand.
My God, and just that's such an incredible scene. I remember in the scene, like you could tell, like they wanted to show it off because they play it over like three different angles from this
oh, yeah.
like, in the movie, because it's just wow, and just you know that's Jackie Chan. He does all those stunts, but. If there's the only American contemporary I would say is close to it is Tom Cruise, because he's notable
for
doing.
Yeah, he does his own stunts. He's crazy too. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he's crazy in a lot of ways, but we don't have the time for that.
But that's why I'm to really dive deep into Hong Kong cinema, because all these guys were basically putting it on the line, just like Jackie Chan was.
Mm-hmm.
Jackie Chan has a lot of charisma, and you know his career definitely took off more than any of the actors that you saw in this movie. But you're still seeing that same grit and determination and just, you know, going in full bore into something with really no safety net. And that's what's so great about these 1980s Hong Kong films.
Yeah, it's just, I can just imagine if it was, you know, action films today where, you know, once again, here we would shake the camera a lot and shoot it from these different
yeah.
angles to mask the fact that we got, you know, a stuntman or stuntwoman on it and they're not really doing their own stunts. And I think,
and then cutting it all, I mean, like, mm-hmm. not even having a shot hold for a full second.
Yeah, or even with somebody like Tom Cruise, like, I think people are too afraid today because of insurance, even though, because Tom Cruise just recently got injured on the set of the last Mission Impossible movie, and production had to be pushed back, like, 6 weeks. So I think because of that, all the insurance problems and everything, American cinemas aren't willing to have somebody do their own stunts because they're afraid it'll cost too much money. And I think that's why we're never going to see that. But in Hong Kong, like you say, they just go at it, man.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the Hollywood industry is all about risk management. That's why you're getting so much movie by committee these days, is they want to, you know, reach as many people as possible, minimize the risk, maximize the profit. And if you have a star that could possibly move production out 6 weeks going down like a Tom Cruise on a Mission Impossible movie, or, you know, any of the Marvel people trying to do their own stunts, they're just not going to handle it. Even if the actor wanted to do it, the idea that these companies would allow that to happen is becoming more and more minute. Whereas, you know, it really was kind of like the Wild West in Hong Kong, because whatever they could think up to do, they would do it. And see if it worked, and a lot of times it did.
Yeah, and just talking about Hong Kong, I mean, now granted, Jackie Chan has nothing to do with this movie, but one of his biggest frequent collaborators was a producer in this film was Sammo Hung. Not only,
yeah.
He is a huge director, he did a lot of Jackie Chan stuff, and the stuff I know him probably best from is the stuff where he was actually a star, like the second Ip Man movie, and then Killzone,
yeah.
Where he probably has he has two incredible fights with Donnie Yen, which you got to go see if you haven't seen it.
Oh, but, yeah, Killzone is awesome.
He's just a legend, and, you know, once again, he's one of the icons of Hong Kong cinema.
Yeah, I mean, Sammo Hung and Jackie Chan, I'm like, I was talking about this before we got on the podcast, but Sammo Hung and Jackie Chan both came up through training in Peking opera. And if you've ever seen the movie Farewell, My Concubine, the first part of that movie is about what kids, because kids were basically just kind of sold by their parents into Peking opera the way that you would sell kids into like slavery. It's incredibly grueling, incredibly intense. The teachers were just brutal to these kids, but it made them just like absolutely the most highly trained physical actors that you could get. And both Sammo Hung and Jackie Chan were like buddies all throughout this. There's a book, I can't remember the name of it, but if you go onto like Amazon and type in Jackie Chan, he wrote or he has an autobiography of the earlier part of his career, and he talks about going through Peking Opera and all the training and how hard it was, and how that basically toughened him up for the entirety of his career, because he could basically go through anything since that's how his childhood was. And Sammo Hung is cut from the same cloth. You're right. I mean, he does an amazing work and so much behind-the-scenes stuff. I know you're talking his acting, and his acting is great. But what Sammo Hung did behind the scenes to really push Hong Kong cinema forward was amazing. And yeah, he put Ricky Lau on this film. It was Ricky Lau's first movie. He had been an action coordinator and done other things in other movies, and Sammo Hung said, you know, I think this guy would be perfect for this movie. And, you know, without Sammo Hung being there, putting up the money and putting Ricky Lau in the driver's seat, we wouldn't have had this. And this is literally the, movie that puts this Jiangxi genre on the map. It had been around before, but it had come out of favor, and this movie put it right back on the map. And they did three sequels to this. They had spin-off movies for the characters that were in this. It was just wildly, wildly successful.
Yeah. You said it was a spin-off. So have you seen any of the sequels and spin-offs of, you know, the stuff that this kick-started?
I actually haven't. When I was talking about how I saw this a long time ago at an anime convention, and I bought a copy of it, which is a total Hong bootleg. I know that you found like a Blu-ray of it, and I'm like, I wonder what that looks. But I mean, like the translation for my movie is like complete English. So I'm probably missing half of what they're actually talking about. Because I had never seen anything like this before. I mean, I'd seen plenty of Hong Kong action films, but nothing with this whole supernatural aspect to it. And it was so entertaining, and these characters are so goofy, like the character of Man Choi, that's played by Ricky Hugh, who has been bitten by a vampire and has to constantly be moving around and dancing in order to try to not become a corpse, and how he has to lay on rice.
That part was hilarious.
There's so much comic relief on top of all the great action that's in this movie, and that I'd never seen anything like it. And I didn't know, because this was back in the early to mid 2000s, I didn't know that there had been other ones that came out about it, and I never really looked it up past that. I really like the actor Lam Xing Ying, and unfortunately, he died really young of liver cancer. He died when he was 44, but that character that he plays, Master Cao Lem, you know, the guy with the single brow, he got really typecast by this role. I mean, he just continues to play this Taoist priest that is trying to control all these supernatural forces, and pretty much all the movies that he did after this, except for a couple of examples. And this really kind of disheartened him, because even though he was constantly acting and was really, really famous and people loved him, he's like, I really just want to do serious roles. And he could never get anybody to cast him in anything like that. And then he ended up, like I said, he died when he was only 44 years old. So There's an element about this movie that's a little bit painful to watch, because you're watching this guy, and he's great in it, and thinking, like, this is the one role that he will play for the next 15 years of his life until he dies. And it's just like, wow, that brings you down a little.
And even getting into the cast of the film, I know want to shout out the guy that played all the vampires. He did a lot of the vampires. I don't know his name, but he played the landlord in one of my all-time favorite comedies, Kung Fu Hustle. And I just wanted to bring that a shout-out, because that's such a great movie.
Yeah. What's the name of the guy that does Stephen Chow, right?
Stephen Chow, yeah.
Chow. Yeah, Stephen Chow that does like the Shaolin Soccers and the Kung Fu Hustles. And that's another, you know, set of films that are really kind of fun and interesting to watch, where you take other genres like the sports genre, you know, and you twist it with all this really interesting action. And also he loves to do things comedy related too. So if you like those kinds of movies, if you like Stephen Chow movies, you've got to check out Mr. Vampire.
So have you seen he's talking about Ricky Lau. This is obviously the only film of his I'm familiar with. Have you seen any of his other films as a director?
No, unfortunately, I don't know much about him as a director. I know that he's directed 20 films, and they're all exclusively Hong Kong films. I mean, he's never really done anything outside of the industry in another place, which I think is kind of interesting given the fact that this film was so ridiculously successful in China when it first came out and, you know, spawned so many sequels and spin-offs. He did other movies with Ching Ying Lam, but he just mostly exclusively has been in Hong Kong, and he hasn't directed a movie since 2000. So I don't know what happened, if there was anything about his films that didn't set well once the Chinese took Hong Kong over back in 1999, but for somebody that was doing relatively well in the marketplace to suddenly just kind of completely disappear, that's really...
Yeah, and then you were talking about how just... You know, how films even from Japan and South Korea have sort of been heavily competing with the Hong Kong market. So any other, like, films, I would say, of the Asian continent, whether it's South Korea, whether it's Japan or Hong Kong, great Asian horror films. Two I want to give a shout-out to, two from South Korea. One is The Wailing, which it came out last year. Have you seen that one?
No, but I think you were talking about it before. Does it take place on a boat or on a train, or am I thinking of something
No,
else?
You're thinking of The Train to Busan. That came out last
year.
Another really good one. But this one is more of a ghost story. It's like there's a lot of murders going on in this town, these gruesome murders, and there's something to do with like this, I think it's something to do with like a ghost. But that's a solid one. I'm pretty sure you've seen The Host, Bong Joon-ho. That's a classic. I highly recommend that one. And then have you seen the Japanese film from 1977? It was called, I think it's called House.
No, but I've heard really, really good things about it, which is why I haven't seen it, because, like I said, I'm not really good with horror films. but I mean, I can give a couple of Japanese movie called Neighbor Number 13. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
Okay, that's spooky. That's a very spooky movie. it's about, you know what, I'm not even going to tell you about it. If you really like horror films... Try Neighbor Number 13.
I'll definitely look it up. Other ones?
There's Three Extremes. Have you heard of that one?
Nope.
It's three different horror thriller stories that are done by three different Japanese directors. So it would kind of be like Grindhouse, but Japanese.
Okay.
And not exploitation, although it is kind of exploitation. So that would be one. But yeah, like I said, I'm really, really not good with the horror stuff. I can't handle it. I mean, I would say something like the Vengeance trilogy is horrific to me. I mean, Lady Vengeance, Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, all those I think would qualify.
Have you seen I Saw the Devil?
Yes,
yeah,
I did.
That one's really, really dark too.
Yeah, but that one's really good.
It's
really spooky, and these guys just kind of one-upping each other about how they're trying to kill each other. That was a really interesting film. I would definitely recommend that one.
Yeah, and I'll throw in I know you don't like straight up horror, but do horror comedies go for you? Because I'll throw out a couple. Just overall horror comedies. The Evil Dead trilogy is one of my favorites.
I've never seen them, and I know that you're going to be like, what?
What?
I know, because everybody loves those movies. I mean, I hear nothing but great things about them.
They're very goofy. The first one's more straight up horror, but the second two get more like lighthearted and comedic, especially the third one. I recommend those. Really old school, the Abbott and Costello meet whoever movies. Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein.
Isn't Bela Lugosi in one of those?
Yeah, he's playing Dracula again, and they have Lon Chaney Jr. play the Wolfman again. It's pretty fun.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Another one I want to recommend. It's came out like 7 years ago. It's called Tucker and Dale versus Evil. It's really funny. It's these two rednecks, and they rent this cabin in the woods, and they're like right next to these like college kids out on a trip, and the college kids think they're like crazy redneck serial killers because like there's always like some series of misunderstandings. Like one time one of them's getting a chainsaw and cutting down some wood, but then like bees get in his face, so he runs around with the chainsaw everywhere, and so the college kids see them, and so they think he's running after them trying to kill them. It's just a whole bunch of misunderstandings, and it's really funny. I recommend that one too.
And yeah, like there's like things that people have told me are really scary. I know that I've had several people tell me that Jacob's Ladder is the scariest movie they've ever seen.
Yeah, I need to see
so
that.
So that means I'll never see it. things like that. So yeah, I'm sorry. I'm afraid as far as a genre person.
But not even
I'm not much help this month.
You're good. Not even like horror comedies, like stuff that's very lighthearted.
I would say Young Frankenstein.
Yeah, that's a great one.
And I would say, you know, if you like old monster movies, I would definitely watch Ed Wood.
Oh yeah,
the biopic that Tim Burton made that stars Johnny Depp. I think that's a great performance by everybody that's in that film.
Yeah, probably.
So if you like movies in general, you should watch Ed Wood. Yeah. It's a great movie.
Tim Burton's last great movie.
Yeah.
Maybe
I'm sure he would be very sad to hear you say that.
Well, I would.
That's been a long time ago.
Yeah. Check that. I might say Big Fish, but
that's Big Fish was good.
Yeah, Big Fish was really good. All right, so that's getting close to the end of my questions. Is there anything else I haven't talked about that you want to bring up now?
I just think that it's great that this is getting a Blu-ray edition, just like they did a 4K restoration. We were talking about this old Dark House because some of these movies people are just not familiar with, and mm-hmm. and they are like literally genre setting movies, and the makeup in this movie was great. I mean, it's a Hong Kong movie, so it's got a limited budget. I mean, they made it for 8.5 million Hong Kong dollars, and they had to up the budget twice because they kept running out of money. Which really made, you know, the people mad, the investors. But Sammo Hung was like, don't worry about it, it'll be great. But, I mean, the elements in this movie are just so lovingly done. The people are working, obviously, very hard. It's incredibly entertaining. So give it a look. You won't regret it. It's a good movie.
All right. Then last question I'll have is just tell us a little bit about your classes.
Well, right now I've got three. I've got American Cinema, Intro to American Cinema on Fridays. I've got Intro to Cinema on Wednesday evenings. And I've got Introduction to Humanities, which is online. And we're hitting the midterm right now, so it's exam week. So hopefully my students are all prepared and ready to go for their exam.
Okay. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been talking about director Ricky Lau and his 1985 film, Mr. Vampire. Don't forget you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. Professor Dutter, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thank you very much.
For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying so long, and we will see you next week.